From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the coronavirus is surging across almost every part of the country, a rising curve of cases that's been even steeper since Thanksgiving gatherings. And Dr. Deborah Birx, the White House coronavirus response coordinator, took Americans back to basics yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press.
I think it's really important that every single person understands that the way this virus is spread is if you're with anyone indoors without a mask, that's a viral spreading opportunity. If you're outdoors and hugging and kissing individuals, that is a viral spreading opportunity.
Let's check in on three places around the country, starting in upstate New York. Emily Russell is a reporter at North Country Public Radio. Welcome.
Hi there, Tanya.
Emily, we've talked a lot about New York City, but give us a picture of COVID-19 in your region of New York. What are some of the hotspots and areas of concern right now?
Yeah, it feels like it's getting worse in upstate New York every day. The number of cases are climbing. You know, it's a lot colder now. Winter is setting in, and we know people are still getting together with friends and family, leading to what Governor Andrew Cuomo calls living room spread. It's the worst in New York State. In western New York, around the city of Buffalo, that's getting hit the hardest right now. Again, this is a place that's pretty deep into winter, and people are staying indoors. Some are still socializing. The region has had the highest infection rate in New York for weeks now. Also, the highest hospitalization rate. State officials have canceled non-essential surgeries there to free up hospital beds.
We know a lot about these numbers and the increases because people are getting tested. But how is access to testing in places like Western New York for people, especially in some of those remote areas?
Yeah, this part of our situation is improving. I'll say the region I cover in northern New York, some healthcare centers are using mobile testing sites to reach people in really remote places. Hamilton County, which is the least populated county in all of New York State, is now for the first time seeing community spread, and they've had testing sites, multiple testing sites around the county every day for the last week. I should say we are still falling short on rapid testing. You know, it's still really limited in the region, and the turnaround time for normal testing is getting longer as more and more people are getting tested.
We're all looking forward to this vaccine, and the Pfizer vaccine, if approved for emergency use, is expected to be available within the next week or so for the highest priority first responders and residents of long-term care facilities. What can you tell us about plans to distribute the vaccines in northern and western New York?
Yeah, that's right. A lot of planning and prep is underway right now to distribute that first shipment of vaccines. We're told there's going to be about 170,000 doses statewide in that first batch, and that's for a population of 19 million people. The Pfizer vaccine needs to be stored at about negative 70 degrees Celsius. So there's a lot of special equipment needed, things like specialty freezers. I cover a region where hospitals are pretty few and far between, so this is going to be a real challenge to get the vaccine, you know, out to elderly and vulnerable people in really remote areas.
A lot to watch for. That's North Country Public Radio reporter Emily Russell. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanya.
Let's go to Iowa now, where the number of COVID-19 patients in hospitals dropped below 1,000 over the weekend. But that number is still twice as high as the peak during the summer surge in that state. And the seven-day rolling total of COVID-19 deaths in Iowa reached 307 on Sunday. That's a new record high. Natalie Krebs is the health reporter at Iowa Public Radio. Natalie, how have hospitals been faring?
Yeah, so you're right. Hospitalizations have been dropping in Iowa, but, you know, they're still pretty high, meaning a lot of hospitals here in urban areas aren't able to take transfers as quickly as they'd like, and they've, you know, canceled a lot of elective procedures. Remembering Iowa is a rural state, so we have a lot of smaller 25-bed hospitals, and so it's not very hard to kind of overwhelm them with ICU patients, especially as, you know, the spread of the virus is across the whole state.
Yeah. Well, I just had a knee replacement scheduled for next week canceled. So this is happening here, you know, in Massachusetts as well. But what are some of the hotspots in the state?
Yeah. So we've seen a big increase in the number of nursing homes that have reported outbreaks in the last couple of weeks, and that has contributed to a lot of deaths that we've seen high in that category. As well as prisons, we've seen a number of significant outbreaks in the state's prisons.
Yeah. Well, Governor Kim Reynolds issued public health restrictions that went into effect November 17th. They're set to expire this Thursday, and they had prohibited indoor gatherings of more than 15 people, 30 for outdoor. People, you know, can't socially distance inside. Masks are required if they can't. Bars and restaurants have to close by 10 p.m. Is there a sense these restrictions made a difference if you've got a little drop in hospitalizations? I mean, and what's the public response?
Yeah. So Governor Reynolds issued these restrictions, you know, at a time when public health officials and hospitals had sort of been begging Iowans to follow restrictions for a couple of weeks. A lot of people responded sort of feeling like these restrictions hadn't gone far enough. She had a number of exceptions for her indoor mask mandate, you know, that people could fall under. And so basically, we're not sure if these restrictions have really made a difference in terms of this small drop that we're seeing so far, given, you know, that a lot of people have felt that they didn't go far enough.
Mm. Well, you know, and again, as I just said, I mean, I just heard from a hospital in Milton, Massachusetts, that they're, you know, going to stop elective surgeries for a couple of weeks. It was very quick. Is there a sense that your governor there may extend restrictions? I mean, what's your thinking about Thursday?
Right. And Governor Kim Reynolds last week, you know, she continues to say she's sort of cautiously optimistic about the numbers that we're seeing in the drop. She said she's still looking at these numbers. She's going to consider to whether or not to extend them. I know public health experts would definitely like them to be extended. I think they'd like them to go further, especially as we approach this holiday season where more people are getting together. There'll be more holiday gatherings. They're considering this to be a very dangerous time.
Yeah. That's Natalie Krebs, health reporter at Iowa Public Radio. Natalie, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's go now to the state of Alabama, where the director of the Alabama Hospital Association recently told a local newspaper that the situation there is, quote, out of control. Hospitals are overwhelmed, and health experts say they haven't even begun to see the effects of Thanksgiving travel. They're warning of what they're calling a tidal wave. Joining us is Andrew Yeager, host and reporter with WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. And Andrew, the positivity rate in Alabama is up to 20%. What's the situation in hospitals right now?
Well, hospital officials are worried of that tidal wave that you described. We've seen a few hospitals that have begun to delay or suspend elective surgeries. But at the same time, they say that we've learned from the previous surge over the summer, we can manage patients better, resources better. So the message they're sending is we will get through this. You know, we're exhausted. We haven't had a break, but we'll soldier on and are practically begging the public to do their part, you know, wear masks, social distance, you know, help out these people in hospitals. They're feeling overwhelmed.
Speaking of mask wearing, Alabama's mask mandate is set to expire on December 11th, just a few days from now. The state is one of a few southern states with a mask order. Is the governor expected to extend it? And if so, until when?
Well, Governor Kay Ivey certainly has faced criticism from some for that mask mandate. But the feeling is right now that she probably will extend it, certainly given the way the pandemic is going and the outcry from the public health community. We'll have to see how long it's extended for. If that does happen, you know, the public health officials certainly would like to see it extended into the new year.
Mm-hmm. We know that the vaccines in contention for FDA emergency approval all require some form of cold storage. We just spoke with Emily in upstate New York, who was talking about some of the challenges of that there for rural communities. Does Alabama, particularly the rural parts of the state, have the infrastructure to hold all of those cold storage units and those types of things?
Well, the State Department of Public Health, they say they have identified 16 sites that can handle the Pfizer vaccine. That's the one that needs the really, really cold temperatures to store. There are hospitals, you know, academic institutions. Now, those do tend to be in larger cities, and they acknowledge that. But they say once the Moderna vaccine, the one that is a little, you know, doesn't have quite such cold storage restrictions. Once that gets going, they expect that will be able to serve rural communities better than the Pfizer vaccine.
Hmm. Something else, Governor Ivey is pushing for schools to return to in-person learning. What's the sentiment from educators on this?
Well, you know, educators would love to be back in the classroom, would love to have things back to normal. But with that said, we've seen, you know, a few school systems after Thanksgiving return to all virtual classes. And that's just sort of the way it is. The head of schools in Alabama at one point described it as rolling blackouts as schools try to adapt to their schedules to how the pandemic is going. And it's not necessarily the issue of infections, you know, kids getting infected. It's teachers and staff as they get infected or they have to quarantine because of possible exposure. They can't get enough subs. And so that's almost been a bigger problem than any infections, you know, with students.
Sure. With the 30 seconds I have with you, I mean, this is dominated coverage. What's the number one thing you're thinking about as you think about this week?
Well, really, it's the issues of hospitalizations. You know, we've seen hospitalizations higher than at any point in the pandemic. And that's just a critical piece of infrastructure for a community.
Absolutely.
So that's really where we'll be watching.
Andrew Yeager is host and reporter at WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, December 10th from 9 to 10 a.m. sdm.mit.edu.
So what does it mean that a federal judge has fully restored DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the Obama-era program the Trump administration attempted to dismantle? In June this year, the Supreme Court ruled the Trump administration did not have a good enough reason to end the program. And on Friday, a judge ruled that the Department of Homeland Security must accept new DACA applications, which had been shut down as soon as today. So what does this all mean? Let's bring in Joel Rose, who covers immigration for NPR's National Desk. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Robin.
And we know DACA gives immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally as children before 2007 and before their 16th birthday protection from deportation as well as the right to work. The 640,000 who are already in the program would have eventually lost those protections, but that Supreme Court ruling blocked that. So what does this new ruling mean for newly eligible immigrants who've been blocked from applying by the Trump administration?
Well, it is a big deal for everyone who has DACA protections, but especially for people who are potential first-time applicants who have been shut out of the program since 2017. The federal judge in this case, Nicholas Garifas in New York, said clearly that the Department of Homeland Security has to start accepting new DACA applications and to post a public notice on its website about how it proposes to do that no later than today. And this is something the Trump administration has really tried to avoid. Even after that Supreme Court ruling in June, the acting Homeland Security Secretary, Chad Wolf, issued a memo a few weeks later that once again blocked new DACA applicants. But the judge in New York ruled that Wolf was not lawfully appointed to the job and vacated that memo.
No, and since DACA began under Obama, hundreds of thousands of these young immigrants have been in the program. What do we know about its impact on them?
Well, the research suggests that DACA has been hugely beneficial. It's allowed DACA recipients to work, to go to school, to pursue graduate degrees, to buy houses and buy cars, and basically, in many ways, just be Americans. These are things that perhaps they technically could have done if they were undocumented immigrants, but DACA has made those things much, I mean, they are undocumented immigrants, but, you know, without DACA, these things would have been difficult. DACA has made them much easier. And there is data to back this up. As of 2017, more than 90% of DACA recipients were currently employed. More than 70% were pursuing a bachelor's degree or higher.
Right. And the Department of Homeland Security says it will abide by this ruling while the Justice Department prepares an appeal. But, Joel, some might be asking, what does this matter? Because we know Joe Biden has said he would restore the program, although some supporters are saying it needs to be a law because of what they've been watching, you know, people trying to dismantle it. So what's the future look like for DACA?
Well, you're right that this case may not matter all that much once the Biden administration takes office. The president-elect has promised to reinstate DACA in full, possibly as soon as day one. But there is another lawsuit that is moving through federal court in Texas that was brought by the attorneys general of Texas and other states who argue that DACA was illegal in the first place when it was created by the Obama administration. And the federal judge there, Andrew Hanen, seems sympathetic to those arguments. He is holding a hearing in the case later this month. And that is why DACA supporters want Congress to step in. They say that they are looking for a law that would make these protections permanent. Whether that is possible in this current political climate will depend, of course, on the balance of power in the Senate, something that won't be settled until after the Georgia runoff elections in January.
Right. That was going to be my next question. Is that even possible? But just meantime, remind people, because it's sometimes cast as an ongoing program. To be eligible for these new applications that, again, are starting again today, you have to have come here, you know, before a certain year and have been a certain age.
That's right. Before 2007, you have to be continually present in the U.S. since before 2007. And, you know, that would exclude many young immigrants who were not even born in 2007, right, let alone present in the U.S.
Right. Joel Rose, who covers immigration for NPR, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, let's take a break now for just a moment from all our earthly woes and consider instead the night skies, where some pretty spectacular celestial events are going to take place this month. And we're going to bring back one of our favorite stargazers, Dean Regas, head astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory, former host of PBS's Stargazer Show, author of 100 Things to See in the Night Sky. Dean, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
And what are some of the things we're going to see, including something that hasn't happened since 1623? That's a while.
Oh,
what's
my
that?
Goodness. This is one of the rarest things that we will ever see. We have the two biggest planets in our solar system, Jupiter and Saturn, coming together in what's called a grand conjunction. And so they get close together about every 20 years or so, but this one is going to be exceptional. And on the night of December 21st, they'll be so close together that you can see them both in a telescope at the same time. They haven't been this close since 1623.
Wow. Will you be able to see the rings and those bands around Jupiter?
Oh, that's what's so great about this is you just need a backyard telescope, a simple beginner telescope, and point at the two objects up in the sky. To the naked eye, you'll be able to see them apart just barely. They'll almost be touching. But through the telescope, then you can see the moons of Jupiter, the bands across Jupiter, and then, of course, the beautiful rings of Saturn. And I mean, I see them each individually, but at the same time, oh boy, this is going to be great.
Oh, it is. Any other tips on how to see it?
If it's cloudy on the 21st, there's a backup plan. So the night of the 20th and 22nd, they're going to be pretty close. So you at least have three nights where you can see them really close together, probably in a scope. But the 19th could be good. The 23rd could be good. I'd say don't bet on just the 21st to try any of those nights, and you'll see them getting closer together. You just need a clear view to the southwestern sky and just a little bit of magnification, not a giant telescope, but just a little scope will do it.
Boy, I can see this being one of those events that people travel for, to have a clear sky in order to see
this.
Oh,
I'm watching the weather very carefully. If I have to travel, maybe I'll come up to Boston area. I don't know. We'll see which way we go.
And of course, we have to say if you travel, you have to travel carefully. But don't worry if you miss it because you can see another one in 2080.
Oh, yeah. Don't worry about it. You miss this one only 60 more years till the next one. At least we didn't have to, you know, we had to wait almost 400 years for this. But no, I think this is going to be a lot of fun. And people have been noticing the two planets getting closer together up in the sky, the grand conjunction. Oh, it's going to be really cool.
Okay, so make note of that. But other celestial events, there's going to be a Geminid meteor shower December 13th and 14th. How best to see that?
Yeah, the Geminids have been putting on good shows the last couple of years, and this is an annual meteor shower, and the best way to do this is to go out, get away from the city lights as much as possible. We don't have a moon that's going to be in our way, so that's going to be good, and the darker the sky, the more meteors you're going to see. And so I know there's all these websites that say, oh, you're going to see 80 or 100 an hour, but more realistically, you'll probably see more like 12 an hour. So little shooting stars going across about one every 5 minutes or so, and a good excuse to get out there and do some stargazing.
Two lunar eclipses in 2021?
Yes, we've had a little bit of an eclipse drought, but we got two good ones coming up May and November of next year. One's going to be almost a total lunar eclipse. One will be a total lunar eclipse. That's when the moon turns that kind of eerie shade of orange and red, and also gets the nickname of the blood moon and all that stuff. And one of the nice sights to see, at least that'll tide us over a little bit till the total solar eclipse in 2024.
And by the way, will those be seen everywhere, the lunar eclipses?
The lunar eclipse in May is a little bit better to see on the western half of the United States than the eastern half. And then in November, it's pretty good across the entire country.
By the way, you've been mentioning backyard telescopes. Boy, wouldn't that make a lovely Christmas gift for someone? Except they're hard to get. Have people been buying them up? Is this become a hobby because of COVID?
I think it has. And you can't get a new telescope anywhere. We've ordered telescopes back in July, and we still haven't gotten them. It's just the demand is so high right now that people are doing this on their own. So, yeah, we apologize to people trying to get telescopes for the holidays, but there's still lots they can see on their own.
Just pick out something that's gorgeous in the night sky that people can go out and see in the month of December, just something pretty they can see with their bare eyes.
Well, I have a lot of favorite stars and favorite constellations, but I'll say my favorite is Orion. That's the constellation that comes up in the wintertime. And so if you're up a little bit later, past 8 or 9 o'clock, you'll start seeing him rising up in the east. And it's the one of three stars in a row for a belt. And he'll just come up sideways. The three stars will come up in a vertical line. And then the stars around it just looks like it's just a really nice pattern to look for. And we'll have that all winter long.
Yeah, you always forget Orion's like tilted.
Yeah, when he starts coming up, he comes up on his side, at least from where we are. And then when he moves over to the southern sky, then it's standing upright. But it's definitely one of the best constellations to see. You don't need a telescope for it. You know, Mars is still up in the sky also, that you could see this kind of bright red light up in the south. And it's very high in the sky and noticeable. So there's plenty to see without a telescope, too.
And by the way, Orion has a bow, right? Like a bow and arrow?
Well, it depends on how you picture him. I've seen him with a bow and arrow. I've seen him with a sword and a shield. I've seen him with a club and a shield. And some elementary school students sent me a picture they drew of him with a baguette. I thought that was kind of fun. And a butter knife hanging from his belt. It was so you can imagine whatever you want.
Somehow, when I was getting my Girl Scout badge, I do not think we were thinking yet of baguettes. Dean Regas, head astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory, author of 100 Things to See in the Night Sky. Dean, thank you so much. It's always such a pleasure to remember the pleasures. So thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. It's a great time of year to just kick back and get outside and look at the stars. And it's stuff we kind of forget about sometimes, but the stars will go on and we just like people to keep looking up.
And if you want to look now and see whether you think Orion has a baguette or a bow and arrow, we've got pictures here and now.
Today is the last day in Georgia to register to vote in next month's high-stakes Senate runoff. And last night, incumbent Senator Kelly Loeffler and her Democratic challenger Raphael Warnock went head-to-head in a debate. Let's bring in Emil Moffitt of WABE in Atlanta. And Emil, what a weekend for Georgia. Both Senate candidates are fairly new to politics. What stood out to you at last night's debate?
Well, the candidates took very different approaches. Senator Loeffler was very stringent in sticking to her message, which she repeated over and over. She noticeably didn't call her opponent Reverend Warnock or Dr. Warnock, but instead referred to him more than a dozen times as radical liberal Raphael Warnock, and says the policies that he supports will, in her words, fundamentally change America. At the same time, Warnock took a conversational approach, I'd say, discussed his upbringing, his experience as a pastor helping out his community, but he also took several swipes at Senator Loeffler for being out of touch and repeated attacks that Loeffler has used her position as a senator to profit off the coronavirus pandemic.
And I want to ask you a little bit more about Warnock and his performance last night. But President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence were also in Georgia over the weekend campaigning for both Republican candidates. Trump again falsely claimed that he won the election there, and And last night, Senator Loeffler, when asked if she believed the election was rigged, said this.
It's very clear that there were issues in this election. There are 250 investigations open, including an investigation into one of my opponent's organizations, you know, for voter fraud. And we have to make sure that Georgians trust this process because of what's at stake in this election.
Emil, we, of course, know the latest recount in the state gave President-elect Joe Biden an undisputed victory there. What does Loeffler's answer signify about the line she's trying to walk as a Republican in Georgia?
Yeah, what she didn't say was that President Trump had lost the state, which, of course, he did. And that appears to be a kind of a nod to the president and the president's supporters who continue to claim without evidence that there was widespread fraud in Georgia's election in November. And this is an effort, it appears, to sympathize with the Trump base, encouraging them to go out and vote in January, even though many Trump supporters may feel that their vote somehow won't count in the runoffs, even though there's been, again, no evidence of widespread fraud in Georgia's elections.
Right, right. I want to ask you again about Warnock. He dodged some questions about the coronavirus relief package. Do you think that he missed an opportunity there?
Well, it very well could have been. To mention some exact numbers, it was an opportunity to dispel the Republican argument that Democrats just want this blank checkbook to spend as they wish, especially if they have control of the Senate in addition to the House and the White House. And Reverend Warnock, his argument was last night that earlier stimulus money favored big companies instead of everyday Americans. So he appeared to be more focused on kind of where the money was going as opposed to how much they would be actually asking for.
Yeah, I've got about 30 seconds with you, but I got to ask you about the other Senate race. So Democrat John Ossoff debated at an empty podium as incumbent Senator David Perdue refused to participate. Why did he decide to skip the debate?
David Perdue said that he had already participated in debates during the general election and said there was, I guess, nothing left to say. But that was quite the interesting visual of Ossoff standing next to that empty podium. Mm-hmm. And Ossoff several times called Perdue arrogant for not showing up.
Right. We'll be keeping a close eye on Georgia as we head toward the Senate runoff elections on January 5th. As always, thank you so much, Emil.
It's my pleasure, Tanya.
The UK is gearing up to administer the first doses of a coronavirus vaccine tomorrow. And here in the US, the Drug and Food Administration is set to meet Thursday to consider emergency use authorization for that same vaccine from Pfizer and BioNTech. For more on when the shot will be widely available here, we're joined now on Skype by Dr. Tom Inglesby, director of the Center of Health Security at Johns Hopkins. Hello, doctor.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So as we know, a vaccine can't come soon enough. The latest surge in cases continues across much of the country. Tens of millions of Californians here are under a stay-at-home order. How would you describe this moment we're in right now?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, this is one of the darkest moments of the pandemic for our country. Just to put it in perspective, as of yesterday, the world had about 500,000 cases diagnosed in all countries. And the United States had about one third of all those cases. We're now averaging somewhere in the order of about 200,000 new cases per day diagnosed in the United States. So it's very, very serious situation.
We were all very concerned about a surge in cases during the holiday season. Now that it's been more than 10 days since Thanksgiving, are we actually seeing a spike? And what's your outlook for the rest of the holiday season?
Yeah, we are seeing a spike. It's clear that we're seeing a pretty substantial rise after Thanksgiving. It started before Thanksgiving. It's continuing upward after Thanksgiving. And yesterday we had a record number of hospitalizations for COVID patients across the country. So unfortunately, it is, as many people worried, a reflection of people mm-hmm. coming together in the holidays and unfortunately passing the virus and transmitting it. We can see that vaccine is likely to be coming in the first part of 2021 for people at highest risk. And that's really exciting news, but we have to get there first, and it's going to take months. And in the meantime, there is the potential for a lot of people to become seriously ill, hospitalized, or die from this virus. But it's in our hands what happens. People can decide whether or not they try to pull back a bit, have less social interaction, or when they are around other people, whether they do it as safely as possible with masks, distancing, avoiding indoor gatherings. Those are the kinds of things that will reduce transmission in this country.
Well, let's talk about those vaccine prospects. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar actually told Axios that every American will be able to get a coronavirus vaccine by the second quarter of 2021. So we're talking anywhere from April to June. Do you think that seems realistic?
I think there are a lot of uncertainties at this point. I think I am confident that the vaccine program will begin soon. I have less confidence in exactly the mechanics of the vaccination program. I think we're still learning more about that. I'm hopeful that it will go well, but I think we haven't seen a lot of detail about how states are going to do that. Having everyone vaccinated by the second quarter of 2021, that seems pretty optimistic to me. It seems like it's going to take somewhat longer to get the whole country vaccinated, but I do feel like a lot of the country will start to get vaccinated in the first and second quarter. At least that's what I'm hopeful for.
Well, to your point about the mechanics, there are definitely concerns about the distribution of these vaccine candidates. Both Pfizer and Moderna's requires two shots administered separately, and they need to be kept in cold storage, as we've been hearing. Do you have any concerns about the supply chains of these vaccines or really the logistics that we're talking about? And do you think that it's going to make it harder to get everyone vaccinated quickly? Those are the things that are probably at the forefront of your mind and many others.
Yeah, I do. I mean, you're exactly right. And so special procedures are being put in place to try and manage that. And a lot of time and attention has gone into that. So I'm hopeful that will work as planned. But you're right, it adds a lot of complexity. And that's going to really depend on that particular state's plan. And those plans aren't entirely clear yet across the country. I think we're learning more and more about those plans. So we'll know more about that in the coming weeks.
That's Dr. Tom Inglesby, director of the Center for Health Security at Johns Hopkins. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
And as we've been hearing, the current rise in COVID-19 patients is really straining ICUs across the country. And to tackle this surge, health officials say hospitals need to work together and share resources and expertise between states. But as the Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck reports, differences over COVID safety protocols are pitting state against state.
In Washington state, the frustration is palpable.
For our healthcare workers to be having to put themselves at risk for residents of states who are not following the best science is exceptionally frustrating.
That's Cassie Sauer. She's the CEO of the Washington State Hospital Association, and she's complaining mostly about neighboring Idaho. Over the past several months, Washington State has followed stricter public health protocols than many Mountain West states, including a statewide mask mandate. In mid-November, Washington went into another lockdown as cases surged again. Meanwhile, in Idaho, there are no plans for a lockdown. And while some local ordinances require masks,
we are seeing noncompliance with these local orders.
That's Idaho Governor Brad Little in one of his regular pandemic pressers. Despite the jump in COVID-19 cases, Little says a statewide mask mandate is impractical. He looks to local governments to make the decision, and even then, he says law enforcement officers can't be everywhere. Instead,
this comes down to personal responsibility.
Still, Idaho is among the top states for infection rates in the country, and some of its hospitals are running out of ICU beds. Likely as a result, an increasing number of Idaho patients are driving to Washington hospitals near the Idaho border. Back in Washington, Cassie Sauer says some hospitals are pushing back.
One of the hospital leaders said, we do not support extending an invitation to send us more.
A federal mandate says hospitals with the resources must take critical patients from anywhere if they have room. If they refuse, they face steep fines. But Mashita Beer says what's really at stake here is getting hospitals to work together.
Because you don't know who's going to be next, and that's really the reality of it.
Abir is an emergency doctor at the University of Michigan's hospital and a policy researcher for RAND Corporation, a nonprofit think tank.
Today it may be Detroit, tomorrow it may be Grand Rapids.
Mashid says these feelings of resentment, of not wanting to treat someone from another state, are a manifestation of something else. The stress and mental fatigue of watching people die while citizens and politicians refuse to follow science-backed health recommendations.
Because I think at the root of not wanting to take care of people from across the border is mental health issues, is stress, is kind of having it. You've reached your limit.
Abir says states need to stop bickering, like they did early on in the pandemic over PPE and ventilators. She says a national plan is needed, one that doesn't pit hospitals against each other for a pool of limited resources.
We have to really realize that the pool is narrow, but not everyone is going to need all those resources at any given time. So there's definitely plenty of room for sharing and collaboration.
Ian Hunter sees the need for collaboration, too. He's chief of staff at Sheridan Memorial Hospital in northern Wyoming.
COVID is so hard.
As of late November, Hunter could still send his trauma patients 130 miles away to Billings, Montana, but the hospital there doesn't have room for his COVID-19 patients. Still, it's working to help his patients in other ways.
We do telemedicine with them. So daily we have consultations where they can help us manage some of our sicker patients, ventilated patients, and other complicated issues.
Working at a small hospital, Hunter says he never expected to be caring for patients this sick. He expects infections to continue to surge, so as the county's public health officer, Hunter ordered a mask mandate. His governor, Mark Gordon, on the other hand, doesn't think a statewide mask mandate is necessary in Wyoming, even while recognizing the regional coronavirus crisis.
When you see Eastern Idaho Regional Medical Center close their hospital, that's a problem. When you see Billings Clinic close their hospital, it's a problem. When South Dakota has to send their patients to Wyoming because they're too full, that's a problem. And when we have capacity issues down in Colorado, that's a problem.
Moving forward, every state in the Mountain West projects COVID-19 rates will climb and their healthcare systems could be overwhelmed in the coming weeks or months. Some Utah facilities are already rationing care. States like Wyoming and Idaho pride themselves on rugged individualism, but in Washington, Cassie Sauer says they don't exist in a bubble.
Those two ideas can't exist together. Either you do it on your own and you really do it on your own, which means patients don't come to our states, or you start following the science and wear your masks and keep distant.
For Here and Now, I'm Madeline Beck.
We can create an economic recovery for all. Those words are from President-elect Joe Biden in a tweet over the weekend. He said the country can move from crisis to recovery to resurgence. Really? This after the Labor Department reported Friday that the economy added just 245,000 jobs in November, less than half of October's job growth. Well, our next guest says there may be a path to that resurgence. Derek Thompson is staff writer at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does every Monday. But Derek, first let's look at the headwinds that we also see for President-elect Joe Biden, that pretty sour jobs report last week. And you've also said to us, you know, this is the strangest economy ever, a GDP that's cratered, millions of people lost their jobs, and small businesses have been clobbered. So look there first.
Sure. Let's start with that thesis that this is the strangest economy ever. Diving into the jobs numbers, we learned that the economy added 245,000 jobs in November. That would be fine if we were emerging, if we weren't emerging from a recession, but we are emerging from a recession, so it's not great, and it definitely represents a pretty clear slowdown in economic recovery. And the source of that slowdown isn't particularly mysterious. It's the pandemic and the resurgence in the late fall, early winter. You look at employment industries like retail, hotels, restaurants, the places most likely to be affected by wintertime shutdowns, they're all doing horribly. Employment in leisure and hospitality, that's restaurants and hotels, amusement parks, still down 3.4 million since February. That's not just a recession. That is a depression. So what is so strange about this economy as we head into 2021 is that some sectors are doing just fine, and then you have others like the restaurant industry, which is practically suffering the worst depression in living memory.
Well, and by the way, Biden has called on Congress to pass this coronavirus relief bill that's hanging. He wants another one. But just while we're here, what are you expecting from his economic team in the first months of the next year that will differ from President Trump's approach and impact the economy?
I think there's two places to look where his approach is going to be very different. Number one is very clearly the coronavirus. I imagine that he's going to try to pass something else, maybe a healthcare support bill or a state and local government relief bill. I think that he's going to be laser focused on the coronavirus in January and February. And then second, you know, he has said for a long time that he wants to repeal the corporate income tax that was tax cut that was passed under Donald Trump, one of the singular legislative achievements of Trump's 4 years. He said over and over again that he's going to repeal it. So I would look for Democrats maybe later in the year to look at that repeal. But I would say those are the two places to focus on: COVID, number one, and then corporate income taxes, number two.
But meantime, you're also saying there's another side of this coin of all the problems we're having. You're also looking at records in the stock market and in the housing market. Talk about that.
Well, this is why it's such a strange economy and why, despite just the horrific year that we've had in 2020, I really do think that the economy in 2021 could be something verging on spectacular. Now, that might sound really Pollyannish, so I'll defend that very quickly. In almost every recession since the 1970s, national wealth has taken a beating because the housing market has cratered. Just look at the Great Recession in 2007, 2008. But this time is truly different. Home prices are setting records across the country at the very same time that overall national personal savings rates are actually at a record high since the 1970s. Now, that's uneven. You might have some, you know, upper middle class families that have a lot of money that they've stocked away since they've, you know, skipped on a couple restaurants and trips, while clearly lots of other families are struggling financially. But nationally, we have this high savings rate. And when you have a healthy housing economy plus a high savings rate, that is a perfect recipe for a strong bounce back once you have all of these hotels and restaurants and amusement parks and retail stores opening, hopefully, in the middle of the summer of 2021. People will have a lot of money they've been sitting on to spend at these places. And so I really do think that despite the horrific 2020 that we're coming out of and a very difficult winter that we are all about to go through, the late spring, early summer of next year could be one of the strongest periods of economic recovery in living memory. And I think that the statistics bear that out.
Remember, you're on record. But you do say that this strong housing market and record high savings is about the most ideal starting point for a recovery you can hope for, because demand for homes jumpstarts all sorts of other industries, you know, construction, furniture sales. But you also say, and we just want to make sure we get this in because some people are suffering so much, we need to pray that that upper middle class savings that you're talking about becomes next year's lower middle class raises.
That's exactly right. And this is such an important point because, you know, the economy is so unequal that pain is always unevenly distributed. But it is particularly unevenly distributed today. And it's really important that we get back to a place at the end of 2021 where the unemployment rate falls below, say, 5%, which is going to build a lot of energy for wages at the bottom to rise. That's what was so wonderful about elements of the economy in the last 5 years, what we should hope for the next 5 years.
Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And that's what we will hope for. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. As the United Kingdom begins vaccinating people with the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine this week, a key FDA panel is expected to approve the vaccine for use here in the United States. That's next time on Here and Now.